Lord Alton, thanks very much for joining us on Aid to the Church in Need's Break the Silence podcast. Just wanted to ask if you could introduce yourself, give a bit of a background, summary of your background.
David Alton, I'm a life peer, an independent crossbench peer, but I spent 20 years almost in the House of Commons, and prior to that I served also as a city councillor in Liverpool, so it was a Liverpool constituency that I represented in the Commons, and I've held chairs at a couple of the universities in Liverpool. And over the distance, I've taken a particular interest in Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which is the article that says everyone has the right to believe or not to believe or to change their belief. But of course, that's honoured in the breach the world over. Christians are persecuted in every country where there's religious persecution. They're unique in that sense. About 100 million Christians persecuted worldwide. I've felt that this is a neglected human right, that Article 18 is an orphaned right, as some of us have described it, and that we have to break the silence and ensure that people who care generally about human rights don't discount the importance of the right to believe or not to believe or to change your belief. So I suppose in a nutshell that's my background. I serve on the Joint Committee of Human Rights in Parliament, which is a committee of the Commons and the Lords, and before that on the House of Lords Committee on International Relations and Defence. And I take an interest in a wide variety of other issues. But I would say that the right to believe or not to believe is a pretty central tenet of what makes me tick.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, it's a very serious issue, a very significant issue, which affects, like you said, hundreds of millions of people throughout the world. How have you been championing that issue over the years within, within Parliament, obviously, prior to being a member of the House of Lords? You were an MP for many years. So how have you gone about raising that issue within the political arena of the UK?
I was brought up in a mixed family. My mother was an Irish Catholic. Her first language was Irish. And my dad was a desert rat who came from an Anglican background. But I went to a school named for Edmund Campion. And every day that I walked through the Palace of Westminster here, through Westminster Hall, I of course remember that in Westminster Hall, Edmund Campion stood trial for his faith, as did Thomas More and many other of the Catholic martyrs. You go to Marble Arch and you can see the place where over 100 young men and women were hung, drawn and quartered because of their faith. So in my earliest formation and days, I've known what it means for people to pay the ultimate price for their faith. And as a young MP, it was an issue I started to get interested in and one I started to raise. And I travelled to places like the People's Republic of China, but I also went into the former Soviet Union with a couple of friends of mine, and we collected some reports. We put them together for the Jubilee campaign, which I helped to found. And we got a lot of MPs interested in those cases, more than 100, and Margaret Thatcher, Neil Kinnock, David Steele, David Owen, the leaders of the political parties all agreed to be patrons of the campaign. And for instance, I went to Ukraine, which is a country on many of our hearts and minds at the moment. And I met there a man, a bishop, who'd spent 18 years in prison, Pavlo Vasilik. I met the chairman of the Committee for the Defense of the Greek Catholic Church, who'd spent the same time in prison at a place called Prem in the former Soviet Union, a young priest who'd been sent to Chernobyl to clear radioactive waste as a punishment for being caught celebrating the liturgies in the open. And I realised that actually some of the things that we take for granted, these freedoms which have been hard won, which people sacrificed their lives for, we'd all be living in a fascist dictatorship in Britain if people hadn't been willing to serve in our armed forces and defend this country against Nazism. And certainly that and the nature of Soviet communism, these tyrannies I've seen firsthand. And I think that's inspired and motivated me to be in my own small way a voice for some of those for whom other people won't speak. And it's easy to get attracted by some of the PC fashionable causes, and I've tried not to over the years. I think when you represent a seat, as I did for the city of Liverpool, the great thing about Liverpudlians is they don't do deference. And they keep you on your feet and they'll deflate you pretty quickly if they think you're getting a bit too self-important. And yes, they gave me the opportunity not just to speak for them, but also to speak for others. And it was never a disadvantage when I would fight for re-election for people to know that I'd been in different parts of the world, but right, not on holidays, but going there in order to write reports, to go and meet people and to raise persecution.
Yeah, I mean, that's really excellent. And yeah, I mean, you've been one of the biggest proponents and the biggest advocates for this cause within Parliament, you know, over the past, three decades?
Daniel, one of the things that struck me most was that you have to make alliances around this. So left, right and centre, you have to draw people together. And the Jubilee campaign was a very early example of doing that. But later on, by working with Aid to the Church in Need, but Christian Solidarity Worldwide, Open Doors, all those who have been in the field, working with them. While I was on the board at Aid of a Church in Need, I said, we should do something to try and raise this more in the popular imagination, I suggested.
Yeah.
It seemed a slightly goofy idea, but it seemed to go down well with colleagues, and that was that we'd create something called Red Wednesday as a day on which we would remember those persecuted for their faith. It was a simple thing, but it's taken off, and not just in the UK, but in other places too. And then I suggested to others we should create an alliance through an all-party parliamentary group, not about a specific country, though there was a place for that too, but specifically around Article 18, around freedom of religion or belief. And that form, APPG, now is one of the biggest in Parliament, with members from both houses. And it's wonderful, one of our most recent recruits to that APPG is Philip Mountstephen, who was the Bishop of Truro, whose landmark report into Christian persecution worldwide was written as a result of Jeremy Hunt, when he was Foreign Secretary, saying, I want a report demonstrating the scale of this problem. And Philip delivered that. And now in his new role as Bishop of Winchester, he serves on the benches in the House of Lords. And as recently as this morning, was present with me to meet the American ambassador on human rights in North Korea, a country I've taken a particular interest in. So, you know, you build alliances and friendships in the course of it. And it influences one another as well. The stories that you hear, the people that you meet, one of the young men who was at the meeting this morning turned up at my university office one day 10 years ago. He's from North Korea. He'd escaped not once but twice. My secretary came in and said, there's a North Korean in the reception. And so Timothy came in, told me a story. He'd been tortured. Why? What do you want me to do? He said, I want to learn how I can do something in my country one day. I need to understand about politics and international affairs. Timothy now has a master's degree from Liverpool University. He's been he'd been on the staff in Fiona Bruce's office. She's the Prime Minister's Special Envoy on Freedom of Religion or Belief.
Right.
And he's now the secretariat to the all-party group on North Korea. So, you know, this is the way it should be. You draw people in not just because you feel sorry for them, but you want to enable them and give them the opportunity to make a difference in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess one thing which I'm really keen to know is while you've, throughout the time you've been proposing these initiatives and doing all of this work, you know, what have you faced any obstacles, any challenges, you know, any opposition?
Oh, regularly, Daniel. Every day, some kind of opposition from one group or another. I mean, I've been sanctioned now by the People's Republic of China. I've been banned by North Korea, and I've been sanctioned by Iran. And I'm not welcome in one or two other countries too. But I mean, my daughter, who's now a barrister, but she also has an appropriate sense of perspective, and she set up a little WhatsApp group called Badge of Honour because the family have been sanctioned as well. This was a big mistake on the part of the People's Republic of China, because when I'm dead and gone, they'll still be fighting this cause. You know, does it matter? Of course it matters to speak up and not be intimidated or bullied. At my university in Liverpool, I ran a big public lecture series, and I invited the Dalai Lama to come. And immediately we got a call from the Chinese embassy saying, you go ahead with this, there'll be no more Chinese students for your university. You go ahead with this, and we will break the twinning arrangement between the city of Liverpool and Shanghai. And so the Lord Mayor said to me, and the Chancellor of the university said, what should we do? I said, you get worried when a gunboat arrives in the River Mersey. Keep it in perspective. Do we believe in freedom of speech or not? The Bishop of Liverpool, the Archbishop, the Rabbi, the Secretary of the Hindu Cultural Organization, and an Imam were there on the steps of Liverpool Cathedral to greet His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who gave a wonderful talk about the importance of coexistence, respect, and what Jonathan Sacks used to call the dignity of difference.
Yeah.
Well, we weren't going to be bullied, we weren't going to be intimidated. A few days later, I got a call from the Chinese embassy. Would I come in and see the ambassador? I said, certainly. So I went in to see him, and at the end of it, I said, well, you don't allow people into Tibet anyway, so how would I know if everything I've heard is right or wrong? Would I go? I said, well, I would, if I could take some parliamentary colleagues, if we could fund ourselves and have proper access. And I said, no, I'll write a report at the end of it. You might not like some of what's in the report. And much to my amazement, they agreed. So I went to Tibet, but also en route, went through Western China. And guess what? I met a group of Uyghur Muslims who were worried about what might be coming their way. And of course, these days we talk about the genocide of a million Uyghur Muslims. So don't let yourself be bullied or intimidated or, you know, or accept silence. Two of my favorite saints are Edith Stein and Maximilian Kolbe. Both of them talked about the consequences of when you are silent. And someone else from that generation, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of the great Protestant theologians, said, not to speak is to speak. Mm. Not to act is to act. So we have a duty. We've got opportunities. I mean, this is a privilege that I have. When I stood down from the Commons, I thought I would go back into academic life and that would have a quiet life. And for bad behavior was given a life sentence. But, you know, not being cynical about it or cryptic, it gives me an incredible opportunity. So today on the floor of the House of Lords, I raised the plight of Jimmy Lai, a Catholic who's in Hong Kong, along with 1,700 people who are imprisoned in Hong Kong. Not just because of their faith, but because their faith animated them to speak out in favour of the rule of law, of democracy and human rights, and look at the consequences. Look what happened to Cardinal Zen. We have to speak out for him. Look what's happened to the underground church in China. We now have the sordid spectacle, the sort of thing that Thomas More was tried for in Westminster Hall, of the state, but in this case a communist state, appointing Catholic bishops in China. So yes, I feel very angry about that, and I'm not going to say otherwise. And so today I raised a story that I heard only yesterday from a young man who is now living in the UK. He's one of the BNO passport holders. He was imprisoned under the National Security Act in Hong Kong. They attempted to brainwash him. They told the other prisoners in the cell with him that they had to turn him and make him a supporter of the state. And if they didn't, then they would pay the consequences. And he was then beaten up by them. He suffered violence and some torture. He finally got out of the country and he was in Parliament yesterday giving evidence about his experience and what has happened to others, his friends, his compatriots. He's not been bullied into silence. Mm. And so the rest of us who have these liberties and privileges, we should take them while we can.
So, I mean, with examples as shocking and as visceral as that, why would you say there is so much silence around this particular topic? And I mean, you know, what can the ordinary person do to help address that and to make this topic more, you know, prominent and more widely known?
Daniel, there's lots of things that people can do, but it requires a little bit of effort on their part. And the truth is, and I don't want to sound like too much of a grumpy old man about this, but there are some PC causes that people, it doesn't cost it anything to embrace them, or not very much. I think a different kind of PC is what we need, not political correctness, but political courage. People need to champion what aren't always popular causes. And people dying for their faith in Nigeria is not, for some reason, a particularly popular cause. And sometimes that's because follow the money and look at the trade interests that we have. I'll give you two examples of that. Again, this morning, one of the things that I said on the floor of the House was, why have we not imposed any sanctions on a single person in Hong Kong while the United States has imposed sanctions on 47?
Right.
Why have we sent government ministers to Hong Kong who've not raised human rights issues but have gone there to deepen our trade links? Why is it that we now have a £50 billion trade deficit with the People's Republic of China? So that's money driving it.
Yeah.
Nigeria is similar. Why have we turned a blind eye to the kind of people that Aid to the Church in Need brought here? You will remember we talked together when Margaret and Dominic Atta were here. And they were two, of course, of the 40 in Ondo in their parish church on Pentecost Sunday when 40 people were murdered.
Yeah.
And Margaret lost her legs in that bomb attack. Why are we silent? Why is there no indignation about them? No one has been brought to justice. Why do we not speak out about Leah Sharibu? This 14-year-old girl has now spent several years imprisoned by Boko Haram because she won't give up her faith. These are fundamental issues. And yet this is driven as well. This is barrels of oil superseding the not just moral responsibility that we have, but the social responsibility to build democratic societies.
Yeah.
How does it look when a country like ours is so silent on these questions, or then attributes, as the president of the Republic of China, of the Republic of Ireland did, Mr. Higgins said, oh, well, this all came down to climate change, what had happened at that church in Ondo. The British Foreign Office often has said the same sort of thing. Mm. Don't be so ridiculous. That is part of the problem. But it's an example of a cause that people embrace. And, you know, I'm not a climate change denier. There is climate change and it should be tackled. But, you know, that's easy by comparison with speaking out on this.
Mm.
And I think that is true on one or two other issues I could name as well as I won't. But so we have to take on the tough ones as well as caring about, you know, things like animal rights. Which I don't believe in cruelty to animals, but one day when a fox arrives at Westminster holding a placard saying "Save the human race," we might actually see the illogicality of some of the causes we take up.
No, absolutely. I mean, so you raise these issues within the House. You know, you're a staunch advocate for these issues within the House. How can the listeners of this podcast raise these issues effectively, and how can they contribute towards making a change and to getting the government to pay attention and to act to, you know, ameliorate these horrific situations going on around the world?
Well, guess what, Dominic? You don't need to be a fortune teller to know that sometime in the next few months there's going to be a general election. And that gives people a real opportunity to pin down politicians, not just the sitting members in their constituencies, but the candidates from the other parties as well. Will they join the all-party parliamentary group on freedom of religion or belief if they are elected? That's an easy one to ask, and that builds up the group in the next parliament. Secondly, will they agree in the parliament, if elected, to raise questions, to table early day motions, to write letters to the relevant government ministers, to seek meetings with them, to take these cases up? And will their constituents, during the course of an election campaign, make sure there's usually a meeting which the council of churches in their constituencies will organise, go along and raise freedom of religion or belief? What are they going to do about it? And then after the election's over, don't lose sight of that member. You go back and see them again and again. So what did you do about this? And right. And when they do something, praise them for it. It's easy to slag off MPs. Praise them when they do the things you've asked them to do. Mm. Write a letter to the local paper saying how grateful you are and how grateful people in Nigeria or Pakistan or wherever it may be will be. And diasporas. This wonderful country of ours, they're extraordinary diaspora from many different backgrounds. The Nigerian diaspora is big. Get alongside them and get them involved in this. The Pakistan diaspora is huge. And both of them, by the way, are countries that get massive amounts of money in our overseas aid programs, even though that's been reduced. Pressurize candidates, pressurize the FCDO and the foreign secretary to use that money to promote freedom of religion or belief. We don't do enough of that. So there are, Aid for the Church in Need runs some great campaigns. And if you do nothing else, make sure that in the parish where you live, there's a poster in the church, or that there are leaflets distributed from time to time about individual cases. I was motivated by some of the individual cases that we've discussed during this podcast. There's a young woman who's on my mind a lot, Zhan Zheng. She's a young woman who's a Christian, who was a barefoot journalist, barefoot lawyer, who found her way to Wuhan and asked all the right questions about the virus that came out of the laboratory there and caused COVID. What was this done deliberately, or was it an accident? She asked all the right questions. Right. She was thrown in prison as a result of that. Motivated by her faith into her citizen journalism, motivated by her faith into seeking justice as a barefoot lawyer. Yeah. And what are we doing to raise her case on a day-by-day basis? Have we forgotten about her? Have we forgotten about Leah Sharibu? Have we forgotten about the victims in Ondo? Have we forgotten about the brick kiln workers in Pakistan? We're about to have a small inquiry into
Absolutely.
That. That's the sort of thing that MPs can do. I'm chairing an inquiry at the moment into Nicaragua. We had one of the witnesses that we've had is the former Jesuit provincial. He's been stripped of citizenship. He spoke to us online from Mexico. He set out an appalling picture. There are now a million Nicaraguans who've taken refuge in Costa Rica. And of course, some of those end up in the border of Mexico. And guess what? Donald Trump wants to turn them back. So we've got to do better than that. There are 114 million displaced people in the world. you can trace that back to freedom of religion or belief as well. Many of them are persecuted. And on the other side of the coin, read the testimony given to our all-party group by Dr. Brian Grimm that says those countries that promote freedom of religion or belief are the most prosperous, the most harmonious, the most stable countries. Take North Korea, where I've been four times. People say, well, it's 10 years ago since a Commission of Inquiry report set up by the United Nations, it said that it is a country without parallel. And Mr. Yeah. Michael Kirby, Judge Michael Kirby, who wrote the report, made direct comparisons with the Reich and the things that happened there. And he singles out the treatment of Christians and believers in North Korea. Well, you know, make this a passion. Keep on raising it. Insist that the United Kingdom, which is a member of the Security Council at the United Nations, raises it alongside our friends from the Republic of Korea, because they are now members of that Security Council for 2 years. These are things, educate yourself about what can be done and then get involved. But don't sit around passively grumbling and complaining. Doing nothing will never change anything. It was a great Irishman who was a member of the British Parliament, Edmund Burke, and I'm going to paraphrase him, who said that all that's required for the triumph of evil is for good men and women to do nothing. So that's the choice, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I agree. I think it's very easy to become despondent about these things. And exactly like you said, the best way to, you know, counter that, to overcome that, is by taking action. I mean, we've spoken a lot about, you know, about the silence that this topic faces. We've spoken a lot about the challenges which can be, which can present themselves when trying to deal with this topic. On the other side of that, you know, are there any notable successes, any, you know, big wins that you've had throughout your time as a parliamentarian that you want to highlight?
Well, it sounds as though then I'm sort of just going on about me, and I don't want to do that, frankly.
Well, any big wins in the space?
Yeah, in the space. Okay, well, there have been. I mean, the formation of the all-party group, I think, was significant. The appointment of a Prime Minister's Special Envoy on freedom of religion or belief, which we are now across Parliament trying to have made a permanent position. Fiona Bruce, who has been a friend of mine before she even came into the House of Commons, has been exemplary in that regard. The setting up of some of the individual country groups. I set up the all-party group on North Korea 20 years ago. Seeing the number two in their embassy, who used to have to come in, he describes himself as having been my spy, coming to spy on what I've been saying and doing about North Korean Parliament. He's now a member of the South Korean National Assembly. And we both laugh about what he was once and what he is now. People can change. People should be encouraged to open their eyes. And individual cases, they're the ones that I think back on. I went to Romania once when Ceausescu was the president of Romania. And for reasons I won't bore you with, but I'd been given the opportunity to travel there. And I knew I had the chance to meet him. And I took with me letters of appeal for a Romanian Orthodox priest whose hands had been broken, who had, so that he couldn't make the sign of the cross. He was down to about 6 stone in weight. He was in prison. And this Orthodox priest was well known. He was called Georgi Kautsiu. And I made a plea for him to be freed. Now, it's a bit like the boy in Greek mythology, you know, the one who played the lute to make the sun come up. Maybe he would have been freed anyway, I don't know. But he was freed. And the first place he came to was Westminster, en route to America. Roll the clock forward, 1989, and the fall of communism in Romania. And it did bring a tear to my eye when I saw Georgi Kautsiu on television in Washington reclaiming the Romanian embassy for the people of Romania. I also got to know Lazo Turkish. He'd been a Lutheran clergyman in Romania. He later became a bishop and a member of the European Parliament. He was the hero at Temeshvar. And in Temeshvar, he brought about the rebellion that led to the fall of Ceausescu. So these things, I've seen extraordinary changes. I mean, I was privileged to meet Pope John Paul II and Lech Wałęsa. I welcomed Lech Wałęsa on a visit to Liverpool. Great hero of mine. I mean, he was an electrician who climbed over some railings in the shipyard at Gdansk. He started what became Solidarity. And what he, with John Paul II, did, it brought about the collapse of communism in Poland. What Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan did with John Paul II brought about these cataclysmic changes, that the fall of the Berlin Wall, that everybody said would never happen People told me that wouldn't happen. People told me that apartheid would never end when I was a student and got involved in the anti-apartheid movement. I was told that we'd never see peace in Northern Ireland. Well, we have power sharing. We have a devolved parliament. It may not be perfect, but it's a darn sight better than when I was Northern Ireland spokesman. 3,000 people died during that period. 30,000 people injured or suffered grievous harm during that period. You know, you can change things bit by bit, piece by piece. Politics is a business of patience. It's incremental, it's gradual, but you do what you can, and if individuals can be influenced or changed, or if you can bring about some change in policy or priority, then you should be happy just even to achieve those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to what extent would you say that a specific individual can have an influence on these issues? You know, it'd be very easy for people to look at these problems and these changes that you spoke about and say, well, they're just subject to macro geopolitical factors, and that actually, you know, as we were saying earlier, it'd be very easy for someone to become despondent over them. You know, how would you respond to that?
Well, I would respond by mentioning someone like Jimmy Lai and his son Sebastian, who has regularly campaigned for Jimmy. And has spoken here in Parliament to groups here several times. Jimmy Lai has said he knew that they would come looking for him by speaking out, as he continued to do through Apple Daily in Hong Kong, against the Chinese Communist Party. He knew he'd have to pay a price, but he also said that he wasn't frightened of that, and he knew it would encourage others to have no fear themselves. So I think that's what you do. You have to take what comes your way and try, if you can, to be courageous like a man like Jimmy Lai and stick with it until you bring about the changes that you hope to see. And even if they don't happen in your lifetime, then they will come perhaps in the future. So you plant those seeds and you go on working for it. And you think back to some of the people I've been mentioning. Edith Stein, who was taken to one of the concentration camps. Maximilian Kolbe, who was taken to Auschwitz. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was executed by the Nazis. It must have been a time of great despondency for each of them, but their inspiration, their example, led to others also then doing what was necessary to bring about the fundamental changes, not to give up and to go on working as they did. And in the aftermath of the Second World War, you see people like Raphael Lemkin, who'd lost more than 40 of his own family murdered in the Holocaust, or Hearst Letterpack, who was another Jewish lawyer, working in their different ways to bring about the Genocide Convention, but also the creation of a Nuremberg Tribunal, the creation of things like offences for crimes against humanity or genocide itself, which didn't exist before 1948. You see Eleanor Roosevelt and the team of people who worked for the creation of the 30 Articles in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You see the creation of the United Nations. You see the creation of NATO. You see the European Court of Justice. You see Winston Churchill making his famous speech in Missouri, saying an iron curtain is descending across Europe and why we had to be militarily strong, but going on to say why we also needed alliances between like-minded nations upholding the rule of law. And he based his own passion of preserving our values, not on a deep, great personal faith, but the importance, as he put it, of Judeo-Christian ideals. He saw this in civilizational terms. And I think that we can do a lot worse than look back to the past and think 80 years later, you know, what are we doing in our own lifetimes? And what are we seeing? We're seeing on one hand an axis of dictators, primarily with Xi Jinping and Putin at its head, but they're imitators and they're underlings, people like Kim Jong-un in North Korea or the Ayatollahs in Tehran, or the dictators and authoritarians in places like Nicaragua, but all over the world. You see these authoritarian dictators and even tyrants on one hand creating, as they see it, a new world order, and you see democracies and people who believe in the upholding of the rule of law, who believe in freedom of religion or belief, who believe in diversity and coexistence, and they stand in juxtaposition against one another. And we are in, I think, very dangerous times, but this is not a moment to lose our nerve. Mm. And it's not a moment to retreat into narrow xenophobia or populism. It's not a moment to retreat into our own skin, look after number one. This is a moment to stand together with like-minded people and to recognize that we have to speak out in favor of those who are championing the same things that we stand for and denounce those who are not.
Yeah, I completely agree. And a very, very inspiring and very uplifting note to end on. We're just coming to the end of our time. Before we finish, though, is there anything else that you want to cover in this podcast, or any message that you want to leave the listeners with?
Well, we've talked about many countries, people, individuals, and what people can do. So I don't think I've got additional points to make. I would give a bit of encouragement. I mean, my late mother, who was, as I say, an Irish speaker, my mother used to say, David, it's better to light a candle than it is to curse in the dark. And when I was a boy, she not only emphasized the importance of doing positive things rather than just being negative, she also gave me a jigsaw puzzle, which was quite a clever jigsaw puzzle, because on one side of it, it had a map of the world. And as a little boy, I could never quite get this right. I didn't know where to put in the pieces. On the other side of it was the face of a man. And the great thing was I knew where the nose and the ears and the eyes would go. And when you put this jigsaw together with the face of the man and turn it over, well, the world came right anyway. So my mother, I think, was telling me something rather important there, that if the more we can do for individuals and individual cases and pressure, prayer, all the things that ACN has traditionally done, I mean, keep doing them, because I don't think there's any other way.
Brilliant. David Alton, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.